Thou is the Lord's, and that is great cause for us to rejoice. Because if we think about that, we would understand that battle is for us. And with God before us, who can be against us? Brian is handing out some, and Michael as well, are handing out some simple handouts that were prepared. Basically, what they give is a picture of where Thomas Building ministered, as well as a few dates that we have concerning major events in his life. How many of you know very much, if anything, about Thomas Building? He is one of the reformers of whom we have the least information. At least I wasn't able to find very much. This could be attributed, I think, to several reasons. Possibly the fact that his ministry took place during the very beginning, as we would say, of the Reformation in England. And I think many times when movements such as the Reformation and others begin, they're not seen as movements from the start. And so there was a lack of record about exactly everything he did. In fact, there are many gaps in his biography as a whole. Another reason that we have little information could possibly be attributed to the fact that he worked very much behind the scenes. He was not the man who would go before the eye of all England, but he would reach the men who would go before the eye of all England standing for the truth. Thomas Bilney was born about the year 1495, and even that is basically a good estimate, which is based on a fact that we do have, and that was the completion of his law degree at Cambridge in the year 1520, estimating that he would have started that coursework 4 to 5 years previous to his completion, meaning that he would have been about 20 years old when he started, and you can trace back to 1495, and that is how everyone I have read has more or less come to his birth. His birthplace was in Norwich, England, which if you look at that map that you have, is in the eastern portion of Norfolk, which is kind of on the corner there in the expanded portion of the map, if you can see that. We don't know much of anything about his childhood, about his family life or things of that nature. Like I said, his birth is based on the completion of his college degree. The fact that he existed is a pretty good indicator that he had parents and grandparents. But as far as brothers and sisters, we could surmise that he did, but that would, again, be a guess based on the demographics of England at that time. Most families had more than one child. So if I had to assume, I would assume that he had brothers and sisters, but I can't say that for sure. And kind of reading further into his childhood, we can speculate based on the fact that he was able to go to Cambridge, remembering that this is a time period where men went to universities and only a few men. We can draw the conclusion, and again this is speculative, but I think we can draw the conclusion that he may have had a privileged life child. And the economy in England at this time is far from what we would exist today. We work for monetary compensation so that we can then provide the shelter, food, transportation, and clothing that we need. At this time period, farming would have been one of the main occupations, and all the hands available in the family would have been needed for the planting in the spring, the harvesting in the fall, maintaining the property, the buildings, taking care of livestock. So in many instances, children would be taught the necessities of what they needed to know to get by on the farm or whatever specific trade they were going into, and immediately they begin helping the family, and that was the education what they received, and the rest of what they got was what they learned from life's lessons, you could say. But whatever the case, whether the Bilneys were well off, whether they weren't, we know that he went to Cambridge because it was in the sovereign plan of God that he be there and get his education, which was in law, And as I said before, he completed the bachelor's law degree in 1520. Some months prior to that, in 1519, he was ordained to the priesthood. Now, whether Catholicism was a religion which he came to hold to during his time there at Cambridge, where he was heavily under that influence from the faculty and teachers, or not, or whether it was something he was raised in, I don't know. Based on the knowledge that we have of the church's predominance in England at that time, I think it's safe to say that he would have been under this influence prior to his studies at Cambridge. That's a little bit about his childhood. What I'd like to do, well, for the whole thing this evening, is go ahead and look at his life, at some of the major events of it, and look at his ministry, and then at the end, hopefully make some application to how does this man's life apply to us today. What I want to do, first of all, is kind of step back and look through a broader scope at Europe as a whole during this time, so that we can understand what the cauldron, we would say, of Europe was at the time that he was ministering in regards to the Reformation. March 1516, Erasmus's first edition of the New Testament appeared on the scene. It was then available for study in the Latin language. Also in 1516, Ulrich Zwingli, and this is in Switzerland now, made his appeal for the supremacy of Scripture. In 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg, Germany. And also in 1517, Peter de Valence stood up against Pope Leo X on the matter of indulgences which were being distributed in Cambridge. And Peter was quickly excommunicated for this. In 1520, Henry VIII was once again at war with France. And in 1521, Luther braved the Diet of Worms. To this point, the new learning, or the Reformation truths, which we'll refer to, what we will refer to it as tonight, had yet to impact thought or life much at all around Cambridge. But this was soon to change. It changed very quickly. See, Luther's works from Germany were being smuggled into England. And no doubt the students had greater access to this. The students at Cambridge had greater access to this than anybody. And they began reading them, and the influence of them was felt in and around Cambridge. So much so that the administration caught wind of this. And I'm assuming that there was dormitories there that these guys stayed in, because the administration began searching rooms and confiscating Luther's works. And it all culminated in May of 1521 with a large public bonfire. This is 1521, and as we say, Thomas Bilney finished his degree in 1520. So he was in and around Cambridge while all of these events were taking place. I mentioned that they were burning Luther's works with a large public bonfire. However, an outbreak of plague occurred, requiring the hands of authority to deal with these types of local troubles, and they stopped dealing with heretics, as they call them, for a time there. Remembering again, in England at this time period, plagues and diseases for which there were no cures were very prevalent. Now, I want to consider Bilney's conversion. To this point, Thomas Bilney had not given much thought to the new learning. He was, if you remember, in 1519 ordained to the priesthood. This is an obvious indication that up to that point anyway, he still followed the religious tenets of the Catholic Church, and either had not been greatly exposed to the Reformation truth, or had been and was not moved by it. However, for some time during his ministry, he had been feeling an emptiness in the religious activity in which he was absorbed. As a priest, he would have participated in all the vigils, the feasts, the masses, and all these works, but all this religious activity was done without Christ and could only serve to take him further from the truth. we are blessed to know today because of men like Bilney and because of the Lord's sovereign preservation of His Word, the truth of salvation. The battle is the Lord's and He will have victory. We can rejoice and be thankful tonight that our salvation is not dependent upon our abilities or lack thereof. We're thankful tonight for Christ and for what He has done so that we can have eternal peace, knowing that our position before our Creator is not dependent upon us, but is dependent upon Christ and His work on the cross, a work which cannot be matched in efficacy in any attempt, I might say. Bilney struggled with this lack of inward peace for some time on his own, but there was a point where he began to approach his colleagues, his preachers, or his fellow priests, and others who he worked with there in the church. And again, they provided for him fasts and vigils, masses and pardons were done. But again, all of this was done without Christ. It was done in vain. But for Thomas Bilney, the time of God was at hand. He was not going to be left in the state in which he was naturally. He was going to be pointed to Christ. And you remember we mentioned Erasmus's New Testament. Many scholars were drawn to it by the eloquence of the Latin which he used. But it was the truth that the Lord communicated through that Latin which converted their souls. And so Bilney began to study from Erasmus's New Testament. Again, he was one who was drawn to it by the eloquence of the language. Bilney, as he began to study this New Testament, as he saw in it the work of Christ and nothing about the works of a religious organization or the works of that a person might do, he exclaimed later after his conversion that it was from Erasmus's text that at first he heard speak of Jesus, and that it was specifically Paul's words that Christ came into the world to save sinners. And this is what Thomas Bilney needed to hear. He did not need to rely on what he was doing in the church or what others told him he should do and how he should do it, but he needed to trust in Christ. He was the one that came to save sinners. And the gospel of God is the power unto salvation. And this is what Bilney came to know, understand, and believe, and he was converted. The truth lifted the burden which had held him captive. He was holding himself captive, in essence. But the truth of the Scripture set him free. Now, I didn't mention this previously, but Bilney was a very small man, small in stature. He did not possess a commanding presence. When he walked into the room, you might not look up and recognize Thomas Bilney. But along with that, he was very shy and gentle. But the light of the truth which he had found, which had set him free, could not be hid. And this is why he went forth boldly in his ministry, despite what we would call personal, peculiarities, or he wasn't a, suffice to say, he was shy and he was gentle. And the Lord loosed him anyway. He wasn't obnoxious, that's what I'm saying. Okay. Bilney first begins to share the truth with his friends and his colleagues. As a result of this, a group of men began to meet at the White Horse Inn. Some of these men, I'll read a few of them, not all of them. You might recognize some of the names. Thomas Arthur, John Lambert, George Stafford, and John Fixtel, and Matthew Parker. And soon to join these men were men such as Robert Barnes and Hugh Latimer. It was said that these men could be seen as the sun would set in the evening, some of them walking alone, some walking together down the road which led to the lane just off the road where the White Horse Inn sat. And you can almost picture it in your mind with these men walking with whatever study aids, whatever translations of the Scripture they had, meeting together to study, candlelight, lanterns, oil lamps, what all that would have been afforded them. You can kind of picture that in your mind, remembering that these men were coming to the truth. No doubt not all of them were at the same point, had seen the same light that others had. And so we can imagine that they were studying together around the Word, perhaps teaching each other, perhaps debating, disagreeing with each other. We don't know. But whatever the case, we do know that the Lord was doing a work there through the leadership of Thomas Bilney as the numbers of men continued to grow and come to meet at the White Horse Inn and then go out throughout all England and minister the truth and stand up for the truth in the face of apostasy. George Stafford, who I mentioned as one of the men which was meeting at the White Horse Inn, he was completing his divinity degree at Cambridge, and one of the requirements upon completion of this degree was an oral examination. We have requirements today for the completion of degrees. Candidates for a doctorate degree have to defend their dissertation. Other degrees have comprehensive exams and these types of things which they have to complete successfully. And George Stafford then was going to face an oral exam. Now, Robert Barnes was a preacher who was known fairly well throughout England, especially in and around London, where Bilney's ministry was. He was known for his scholarship, for his authoritative preaching. Remembering that all these men were, Robert Barnes, who we're speaking of specifically here, were a part of the Catholic Church. But nonetheless, he was known for his scholarship. And he was the one who was going to come and put George Stafford through this oral exam. Now, this wasn't a one-on-one exam. I'm sure fellow students were there. We know that administration, faculty members were there. Maybe family, friends were there. Anyone could attend these. And Thomas Bilney and his other, and George Stafford's other friends from the White Horse Inn were, for the most part, there. So the examination proceeds. Now, whether Robert Barnes knew that George Stafford was one of the men who went regularly to the White Horse Inn to study or not, I don't know if he knew George Stafford's holding to the what was called at that time the New Truth or the Reformation theology as opposed to what the Catholic Church was teaching. But anyway, that was the subject of examination. Robert Barnes proceeded to enter into a debate with George Stafford, and George Stafford, this young green graduate, we might say, was able to hold his own very well against Robert Barnes in defense of the truth. And we might even say, if it were a debate and we had to pick sides, that George Stafford would have won this debate. Thomas Bilney, as I said, was present, and he noticed that George Stafford appeared possibly even visibly shaken, Robert Barnes, visibly shaken at Stafford's ability to defend the truth against him. This was all Bilney needed to see. He saw to it that he had the opportunity to meet with Robert Barnes. He approached him, and they agreed to meet. And Thomas Bilney, as you'll see, the way he would witness was simply to give his testimony of what the Lord had done in revealing the truth to him and lifting his burden and setting him free. You see, all these men were heavily involved in the Catholic Church. Bilney obviously likewise, but he explained to them that, you know, I was right where you are. I believed everything you believe, but as I began to read the truth of the Scripture, I was set free. And as he gave his testimony, I don't have the exact conversations they had, but all those who were pointed to Christ and converted by Thomas Bilney talk about that his testimony presented the clearest, it was the clearest gospel presentation that they had ever heard. And as you guessed, Robert Barnes was led to faith. Hugh Latimer was completing his degree and was also required at the end to have one final exam, I guess we would say. And he was required to give an oral presentation, or an oration, we would call it. Now, again, this was an event where faculty, teachers, colleagues, friends, family, and everything would have been present. And I think there's two interesting things that we can consider here about Hugh Latimer's oration. and again, this is speculation, I think it's interesting to consider, so we will. There's something in speech class that I took. One of the 10 principles was that you need, and I'm just paraphrasing this, but you need to know your audience. Well, Hugh Latimer would have known his audience. And again, this is an exam which in large part determines his ability to complete the degree. And he knew who was going to be there. He knew it was going to be his teachers. He knew it was going to be priests and those types. And so that may have played a part in what he spoke about, because he proceeded to defend the church against the accusations of what had been called the new truth. Another possibility, and this might be a little more personal, a lot of times when we're making a decision about something, or we have something facing us, and we need to decide one way or the other, and we know the way we want to decide, but it might not be the best way. Maybe it's with a vehicle we would like. One would be suitable, but the other one is just as suitable, but a little bit nicer. And so we're discussing what we need to do concerning the price even. This one, obviously, it's a little nicer. It's more expensive, even though this one's suitable. So we try to argue to ourselves that, you know, this is why we're going with the pricier car, because, you know, it gets a little bit gas, better gas mileage, this, that, and the other, all these types of things. Well, that's what Thomas Bilney sensed with Latimer's defense of the church. He was a man who inwardly was not at peace and was trying before an accepting and receptive audience, that he was trying to satisfy himself with these arguments. Well, this was all that Thomas Bilney needed, and very quickly saw to it that he and Hugh Latimer were able to meet. And again, he gave Latimer his testimony, and Latimer was converted in 1524. Also, I want to just mention, we won't go into detail about this, but Thomas Bilney, his ministry was not in any way, shape, or form discriminate. He's been ministering and continues to minister to his colleagues and to fellow scholars, but he went to the jails, he ministered to the sick, to the poor, and to the outcast. In one instance in particular, Thomas Bilney, ministering to a jail, came into contact with a woman who had been accused of murder. She was placed in jail, and her children, whether the husband had passed away or maybe she was accused of murdering him, I don't know. But anyway, the children were orphaned. And Thomas Bilney came to the realization that she was innocent through whatever means of this crime, remembering that he had a law degree and would have known what steps to take to prove her innocence. And he did so, and she was able to be released and back with her family. I'm not trying to advocate that he was a detective sleuthing around or anything like that, but nonetheless, his ministry was not in any way, shape, or form discriminate. He went to the sick, remembering that at this time in history, in England, there were many diseases and plagues for which there were no cure. To go in and to witness to one of these folks could in the long run mean your own death. To the sick and the poor and the outcast. And I think that in many ways is very applicable to us here in the location we have in Spartanburg with our ministry and the different ethnic and socioeconomic groups all scattered throughout the neighborhood here, and how we can minister to them. And we see Bilney didn't discriminate in any way, shape, or form. Another area in which the Lord used Bilney, it's kind of humorous in a way. Cardinal Wolsey was the Cardinal Archbishop at this time, and I'm assuming we're all slightly familiar with the hierarchy of the church. There's bishops and cardinals and archbishops and the Pope and all these types of things. Well, Wolsey was a cardinal, and from all I gather from reading about him, a pretty prideful, pompous man, we might even say, and he wanted to leave a legacy for himself. And so in doing so, he decided he would construct a college which would bear his name, Cardinal College. In order to undertake a project of this size, he needed financial resources. And in order to acquire these resources, what he did was he went around and saw to it that 21 different monasteries were shut down, taking the wealth that they had, whatever they had, and their land and their buildings, selling all that. So he got, by doing that, he got what he needed to construct his college, and did so. Well, after its completion, a college bearing his name needed to have the finest teachers. So he formed a committee of men to go find these teachers, and they went to Cambridge to go find these teachers, and they did. And they found some of the finest teachers, in fact, probably the finest teachers. And they began. They had their inaugural, their opening year. As the years progressed and they started graduating classes, all of a sudden there was an explosion of what Cardinal Wolsey and his friends would consider heresy. It was an explosion of the truth in and around the area. Well, they traced it back to the school and found that all those teachers had been more or less persuaded by Thomas Bilney. So, I don't know what you all think about monasteries, but I think of whether they have the truth there or not, seclusion. The truth is there in and amongst them. It's not necessarily channeling out to impact others. But these monasteries were closed so that this college could be constructed, so that until the time that the heresy exploded, the truth went forth through men which Thomas Bilney had reached. And this is just another indicator of Bilney's ministry, a man who we have very little knowledge of, who worked behind the scenes, but he reached men like Robert Barnes and Hugh Latimer, and men who would teach other men at colleges that were set up to spew forth apostasy. And the truth went out as a result, and this is the type of ministry that Thomas Bilney had. The events that we've been talking about more or less occurred during what we would call the calm before the storm, which was shortly to come. On December the 24th, 1525, Robert Barnes, the man who had put George Stafford through his oral examination, who had then been converted after Bilney pointing him to the truth, went out, and this was Christmas Eve, and preached a sermon attacking the church quite vigorously. It seems that his sermon was more aimed at attacking the church than it was proclaiming the truth. Whatever the case, apparently he did not speak the truth in love, because this created problems. The Cardinal Wolsey and the other leaders got this information and quickly picked him up. And he was brought before them, and he went through the trials, and he stood firm, unfortunately, till he was threatened with death. And then he recanted, remembering at this time in England, no one yet had gone to the stake. Men to this point were weak. Sadly, they were failing, and when threatened with death, they would recant. As you can imagine, Barnes' sermon through the floodlights on men like Hugh Latimer and Robert Bilney. The church now was very much aware that there were those out there who were speaking against it, and this was not something that they were going to tolerate. In the winter of 1526, a few months after Robert Barnes had been taken for his sermon, Latimer and Bilney, who were together, who had become very close friends, by the way, they were ministering together, they were taken by the church leadership to be examined about their teaching, to see whether it was against the church. They were both asked questions. We don't know the exact questions. We can guess they had to do with the sacraments and with image worship and all these types of things. But whatever the case, they seemed to like Latimer's answers more than Bilney's. Latimer was given a license to preach. However, Bilney was made to take an oath basically saying that he would not preach anything contrary to church doctrine, and they actually gave him money to help him with his travels. So we see that the church at this point is not going to allow preaching against it to slip by, but to this point they're really not aggressive. They're not adamantly seeking to take these men and slaughter them. In the spring of 1527, a few months following Bilney's first oath, Thomas Bilney set out now with Thomas Arthur, one of the men who would come to the White Horse Inn to meet with him. And they went out preaching, and their preaching was contrary to what the church would have liked. In the fall of 1527, a few months later, Bilney and Arthur were seized. They were brought before Cardinal Wolsey. And it seems that the cardinal almost immediately recognized Thomas Bilney and questioned him, "Did you not take this oath 3 or 4 months back?" And he said, "I did." And remember, Thomas Bilney had a degree in law. He said, "But it wasn't judicially binding. It was just a word-to-word type of thing between us." So we see the lawyer coming out and Thomas Bilney. It's kind of funny, but in reality, is a poor excuse for a man of his standing. This served only to infuriate the cardinal, and he was made to take a second oath, and he did. And now we can think, you know, why in the world are they taking these licenses? Why in the world are they taking these oaths? But we have to remember that this was all these men knew. You know, the Catholic Church was in error, but in reality, it was the vehicle that the Lord had used to cause these men to study the Scripture. And they weren't out to destroy the church. They were more out to stay within the church as long as possible in hopes of reforming it. And we know that that rarely, if ever, works. But these men didn't have the benefit of knowing that. Hindsight is 20/20, as we say. But following a brief hearing concerning this, both of these men were sent to their cells just for a few hours because the trial resumed at midday. It seems that almost as soon as the trial resumed, it was postponed for 5 days. It seems as well that for whatever reason, the cardinal didn't want to deal with this. What he had in mind was Bishop Tunstall. He was to come from London and to oversee the proceedings of this trial. This encouraged Thomas Bilney because he seemed to think that Tunstall was a much more thorough, much more compassionate, much more knowledgeable man than Cardinal Wolsey. He thought that he would weigh everything fairly and that the outcome would be good. Bilney was provided a little bit of ink and paper in his cell, and so he proceeded to write 5 different letters to Tunstall, basically doing what he had done to Latimer and Robert Barnes and others, giving them his testimony in hopes that Tunstall too would be redeemed for the sake of Christ and converted. However, this was not the case. The trial continued, and Bilney was charged on 34 different counts of heresy. I don't know what all of them are, but there were 34. We do know that he was questioned on issues such as image worship, the Virgin Mary, pardons, and all these types of things. And on December 4th, 1527, the trial resumed and conviction was given. Bilney then was sent back to his cell. The next morning, Bilney was given another opportunity to revoke his actions and his teachings, but he stood firm and then was given the opportunity to consult with his friends. Again, we see the church here wanting to squelch the Reformation truth, the theology, but at the same time, they were very hesitant to just crack down hard on these men at this point. They were very, very lenient. He had the opportunity then to go talk with his friends. At 1 o'clock the same day, Bilney was brought back and continued to stand firm on his conviction. They said to him, "You know, here's all these witnesses we have against you. What do you have, you know, to combat these witnesses?" And Thomas said on several occasions, "For every man you've brought to speak against me, I can bring half a dozen to defend me." They didn't allow this. Tunstall in this case was judge, jury, and executioner. But again, they were still lenient. They were lenient, and they gave him 2 days to go consult with his friends. I don't know if they were hoping that the 2 days of freedom would remind him how better life was on the outside of prison, or whether they thought his friends would persuade him that he was more valuable alive than dead. But whatever the case, the 2 days of suspense and urging by his friends had done their work. And sadly, Thomas Bilney abjured on the morning of December the 7th. On Sunday, December the 8th, Bilney was, of course, humiliated with when he was required to give a public proclamation of his recantation. Following this, he was sent back to prison to serve whatever the rest of his sentence was. He wasn't going to die in this instance because he recanted, but there was still prison time that he would have to face. No one had yet to withstand the trial to this point. And I'll read here a quote from the book. The leniency of Cardinal Wolsey and Bishop Tunstall, was more dangerous to the progress of the Reformation than the bloody crusade of Thomas More and Stokesley, who were to take their places here shortly. Death at the stake threw a luster on the cause for which men died. As you can imagine, Thomas Bilney was deeply grieved. Again, I would say he recanted, but whoever amongst us can throw the first stone, go ahead, I guess. He was more deeply grieved than probably any of us could ever be at what he had done. So much so that his friends were afraid to leave him alone. I'm thinking that he might even inflict harm upon himself. And this lasted, we're unsure of the time. Some say as long as a year, but whatever the length was, at the end of it, he found comfort in the mercy of God. And he decided to return to ministry and to remain firm on his beliefs, whatever befell him at this point. Now, during Bilney's extended period of grief and discouragement, Cardinal Wolsey had died. He had lost his position in power. And Tunstall had been transferred to another parish. Taking their places were Sir Thomas More and Stokesley. Bilney went back out to minister and was quickly seized. These men were not lenient, as were their predecessors. Bilney was quickly seized and charged as a relapse heretic. This time the trial was fairly quick, and Bilney stuck to his conviction. In the process of this trial, there were different friars and priests and this, that, and the other who were sent to Bilney again to try to convince him that he was in error, that he needed to recant and come back to the church. And it was said that one of the friars, or some of the men, were almost, Bilney stood so firm in his testimony that some of these men were almost, they left questioning whether they were right or whether Bilney was right. So we see that even to his death, his ministry continued. And had impact. In 1531, we know, we don't actually know, it was either in March or August was his death. The exact date has been disputed. So we do know, though, in 1531 that he was killed at the stake. There were those who tried to maintain that even on the stake, as he was dying, he recanted. They were proven to be instruments that the church had set there to do this very thing, to put the question in the minds of men who might stand for the truth and might face the stake, to say, look at Bilney. Even in his death, he was recanting, but it was too late. He still died. That has been proven, you know, totally inaccurate on many bases. Hugh Latimer himself, who was there, testified to the fact that that wasn't the case. Fox's record of Fox's from the Book of Martyrs, his record of Thomas Bilney's death stands in line with what we know to be true, that Thomas Bilney stood firm until the end. As we see, Thomas Bilney was a small man, insignificant, we might say, physically, a shy and gentle man, but he was a man who the Lord used behind the scenes in and around Cambridge to accomplish his sovereign purposes. And I just want to apply this to us individually. I think there's application, and corporately as well. As we said, Thomas Bilney was a small man. He was shy. He was gentle. All of us, if we consider ourselves in the grand scheme of things, now we might not all be small physically. All of us are diverse in that nature. But Thomas Bilney, a small man, a shy man, a gentleman, yet he was used of God. It was in the behind-the-scenes way, but he would reach men who would go before the eye of all England to proclaim and defend the truth against a church which was trying to suppress it. And when we think of ourselves on an individual basis, we know that in the grand scheme of life, we're very small. If we consider ourselves on a corporate level here as a church, even if there were 5,000 of us in this building tonight, based on the population of this country, that's very small. But the size doesn't matter when the Lord has a purpose that He wants to accomplish, whether it be through us as a church corporately in this community and the outreaches that we have, or whether it be on an individual basis in our families, at work, or with those we come into contact with. The Lord, it is, as the song said, the battle is the Lord's. And the fact that He is the one who wages the war in the fact indicates that there is no other outcome than victory. Secondly, as we observe, Thomas Bilney failed miserably when threatened with death for the first time. And if we are all honest with ourselves, we can say that we fail miserably all the time. And yet the Lord used Thomas Bilney. His impact, which we can't really measure. We don't even know all those who he reached and who went forth. I believe he has impact even on us here tonight as we apply this to ourselves. But Thomas Bilney failed miserably, as we all do. And yet the Lord was able to use him in Cambridge to accomplish his specific purpose that he had there. Thomas Bilney was more or less the spark which would ignite the fire that the Reformation became in England. Starting there at the university, a place where people were taught who had the ability to communicate and the means to do so, and then would go throughout all England. And if we combine that together, our insignificance, our failures on an individual basis and on a corporate basis, and ultimately what it does, I believe, is many things. But the thing we want to consider tonight, first and foremost, is it reveals to us just who God is. It brings more honor and more glory to Him. The fact that He can use insignificant, even shy, backward people who fail continually to accomplish His purposes just as He ordains them to be accomplished is an amazing thing. And we can conclude, I think, by saying, as we consider all this and consider our own insufficiencies, our own failures, we know that as God's children, we have a purpose here on earth. We might not know exactly what it is day to day, but whatever we're doing at that time, I guess we would have to say at that specific time is His purpose for our lives. But we have a purpose here on earth, and despite what we are, the Lord can use us to bring honor and glory to Himself. And so if God be for us, we know that there is no one that can stand against us. Bilney knew this. Bilney was used mightily of the Lord to do everything that we saw here tonight, personal evangelism, the influence he had on the Cardinal College, the indiscriminate ministry he had to the sick, the outcast, those in jail. These are all things that you wouldn't expect a man like Thomas Bilney to be involved in. But the Lord had His purposes for Bilney, and the Lord has His purposes for each one of us, despite our insignificance, despite our failures. We will be victorious because of Christ. And even in the failures, if we look at the men from the Reformation, many of them, Bilney, to my knowledge, was the first in England to meet the stake. There were others before him that recanted, and Bilney himself recanted. But even in the failures that we face, as we've been considering on Sunday evenings, the hardships that come our way. I think that our failures can, in many instances, be our hardships that we face. Even the suffering, even the failures, even the hardships, these are things which are there for a purpose. We don't always know that purpose, but they are. And the Lord will accomplish His will in us and through us, in the timing which He has ordained, through the means which He has ordained to accomplish the purposes that He has ordained. So.